Well, I want to thank you all for coming this afternoon. My watch says it's 2 after that says it's about 2, so we'll get warmed up here. I have no idea how many people are not here because of the posters. I didn't know that my picture was going to be plastered all over campus today, so you came despite that. I appreciate that. Because we have a limited amount of time and probably lots of ideas to share, I just wanted to talk to you about what we're going to do today and what the plan is. Can you hear me okay? We have been working in the strategic planning leadership team now for several months, working on an updated strategic plan. And if you read all that jazz last week, President Jasinski kind of outlined it and sent you a document that summarized very briefly where we've been. And one of the subgroups was in charge of, one of the SPLT subgroups was in charge of taking a look at the new process. And rather than a 7-step process, they proposed a 3-stage process. Stage 1 is gather and analyze. Stage 2 then is to collaborate and consents. And the third stage is to commit and act. We are at the gather and analyze stage, where we're getting information from a variety of constituencies. And this is simply what we're doing today, one way of getting information. You probably saw on the way in the lobby that there's the big tablets of paper where people are writing their suggestions. Bearcatitude.com is up and running. You can leave them there. You can submit your ideas to email through any NLT member. We want your input, and we need your input to plan strategically 4, 3, 5 years out. So what we're going to do today is we met in Dean's Council last week and developed 3 questions that we would like to discuss. Doesn't mean we have to answer or focus only on those 3 questions, but we thought that would be a good start, that focused around academics. And the 4 areas that we are having these town hall meetings on, academics, student life, athletics, and facilities, we thought were those areas that touched each student's lives in significant ways. Notice that we don't have technology as a separate entity because it kind of overlaps with several of those areas, as does some other areas as well. But we're going to focus today on academics. I would encourage you to go to these other town hall meetings and to provide input there as well, and not just come to the academic sessions. Today, we're going to have 4 faculty members who are all familiar with qualitative research who are going to be doing the note-taking. So we really wanted to make sure that we got an unbiased representation of the comments today. Once they are finished, or once we're finished here, they're going to take the notes, they're going to put them together, and provide us with 2 summaries. One is just going to be a summary of all the comments. The other is going to be a summary of their analysis. They're going to look for themes and for consensus among people here today and the ideas. Then they're going to submit both of those documents to the Dean's Council. We won't take a look at their interpretation of the themes until we've kind of discussed what the overall topics were and we've looked at the actual notes. We'll draw our own conclusions, and then we'll compare them with what the qualitative researchers have concluded, just to see how similar they are. Hopefully they'll be similar. And then we will take that information to the strategic planning leadership team for its consideration. And the strategic planning leadership team, remember, is a broader group representation of the leadership team. It's kind of, we sometimes call it the extended leadership team. It has student representation, support staff, professional staff, faculty senate, chairs council, dean's council, and leadership team representation on it. So it's a much broader representation of the community. So today, our goals are to get information. We need your input. I was listening to NPR a couple of days ago, and Governor Crist, or I think he's Governor Crist, soon wants to be Senator Crist, was talking about a delicate issue in the state of Florida, and he says, God gave me 2 ears and 1 mouth, which means he's supposed to be listening more than talking. Hopefully that's what we'll be doing today. We need your input so that we can have this open, frank, honest discussion, what your ideas are about where we should go in academics in the near and distant future. Excuse me. We need everyone's ideas, whether you think it's a good idea, a minor idea, a major idea. We need them all, and just because you give us your idea, though, we doesn't mean we're going to be able to use it, but we need it. it's very important. So, any questions about that before we go on to the actual discussion questions? All right. Here's our first one. You'll notice it's very broad, but we've got a broad representation of folks here. What can we do academically that will differentiate us as the university of choice in this region and beyond? Oh, and I'm supposed to remind you, Gina will get mad, because we're recording this, we need you to step to a microphone over here, or if you're close to this side, you can come up here and use this microphone as well so that we can get this on tape. So we're here to listen. Now it's your turn to talk. This is my job's over. Mark, can you come over to the microphone? Hopefully, you know, you've seen these people who are asking questions, debates line up at the microphone. So if you have a question or an issue that you want to bring forward, come get behind Mark.
Now, one kind of issue we debated in our chairs meeting, Booth College chairs meeting a couple months ago in putting together the our sort of college report was defining the region. And I think for different reasons, we've officially thought of ourselves as the 19-county region and how everybody's moving out of the region and, you know, the cows are taking over and crap like that. Mm-hmm. But I think we see the region as being Omaha, Nebraska, Omaha, Des Moines, Kansas City, that triangle in there. And I think to understand ourselves, we have to understand what's in that triangle, not just the cows and the chickens, but those population centers and those universities in those population centers, what they're offering. Just as a starting point.
Yeah, that's a good point. We have our statutory region as defined by statute, and then we have what Mark was just saying, what we collectively think of. I think certainly I know enrollment management thinks of our region in both the terms of our 19-county catchment area as well as the four-state region, southeast Nebraska, southwest Iowa, northeast Kansas, and then, of course, northwest Missouri. And beyond, if we look at our statistics of enrollment, we have a lot of students throughout Missouri, not just northwest Missouri.
Dr. Dunham, I think that what we can do is probably a lot of what we already do, but we don't really focus on getting the message out. We're experiential classroom teachers. We do service learning, practical experience, field experience. I know I was kind of surprised when I started working with Janeth how many faculty travel with students to different places, and that faculty-student interaction that really sets us apart and moves our students to success. My concern in this area is first off that we don't put that forward as a big piece of who we are, and second off how larger classes will affect this. And I do think that class size should be a part of what we look at when we're thinking about strategic planning and what that means to us and this strength that we have of being very student-centered.
That's a very good point. Now, did I hear you correctly? What did you say about experiential learning about not wanting to continue? Did you say not wanting to continue that? Or
no,
I think for
my department that we believe that this is a very strong focus and something that we would like to see continue to be a focus.
Okay. Well, that was our third question, so I'll skip ahead. And we can put all these up at the same time and talk to them as you want. What kind of experiential learning and or experimental education activities, and when I say experimental education activities, I mean experiments, not experimenting with educational activities per se, should we be offering our students? Let me give you a little bit of background on the second question and the reason for that. When I was talking to Dean Schenkel last week about REAP and where we were in terms of enrollment for the fall, she noted that 39%... Let me back up. We're a moderately selective institution. So according to the state, what that means is that 80% of our students on average need to meet our academic standards, our admissions index, which average is 100. If a student has 100 or more, they've met our academic standards. We're a little bit higher than that. We're at 85% average. Now, the matriculation rate for students who meet our academic standard, 100 or above, is about 39%, the most recent number shows. For those that are below our academic standard, the matriculation rate is 60%. So we have to keep in mind something as we talk about, and we have talked about before, ratcheting up academic requirements, that there's an implication there that if we do that, that might have an impact on enrollment because people who have that index are not as likely to attend Northwest. So the question is then, and these are not mutually exclusive, what is it that we might do to get that student who has that higher admissions index if that's what we decide we want to do? We often talk about the phrase, we are proud that we teach the students that we get, not the students that we want. So we have good success. Our NESI scores show that students are engaged with their faculty, that they perceive this as an environment that is supportive, and based on our retention and graduation rates, the evidence would suggest we do a pretty good job of that. So is it something that we want to do, that we want to move to try to either increase our standards, or an alternative might be, is there something that we could do to try to increase the matriculation rate of those students who have an index or 100 or above? And now I'll be quiet and listen to you on any of these three questions.
Speaking for Ed Leadership and for the Education College in particular, I wanted to go back to the, well, it might be experiential kind of things, but our competition, and we are basically a graduate department, our competition prides itself on having administrators in the field being the ones teaching the class. So one thing I think that we need is the opportunity, time, and resources for people in CNI and in Ed Leadership who teach graduate courses to be out in the schools keeping current, because as we all know, they change. Every year there's a new something coming out, and so it's hard to keep up. So I would say that was probably one of the predominant ones, is having the opportunity to do that so that we can say not only do we have the experience, in-school experience, but we have all the academics that go along with it. That would be key. Carla's class size issue, I think it's an issue in every class, but in education, if you have too big a classes, that makes it impossible to do the things that we know that are best practices, and we have to keep those in mind too. And there's a third one that while I was listening, I forgot. I know you find that hard to believe, that I would talk and listen and forget something. So I'll stand back, and if I think of it, I'll bring back. But it really comes key point to us, if we're going to stay in competition, and we have a lot of it, that we're able to say that we are right in there doing those things and in the schools, and we can use that experience to bring back to the class.
Okay. I first want to start by thanking you for doing this and, you know, having us all here, frank and honest and open and all that. The question I have for it is, this reminds me a lot of what we did at the opening meetings. We get a big question, and the whole everybody brainstorms about it for a little bit and writes something down. I'm not much of a brainstormer. I would like it better if, like, I got the questions like the day before. I'm more of a like take home test kind of person. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's a way that if we all sit around and brainstorm for a few minutes, we're going to get kind of a surface level, kind of like a reactionary reaction. Mm-hmm. Rather than a thoughtful kind of real reaction. And so is there going to be like a part two to this where we're all going to get together and thought about these questions a little bit more and then, you know, that sort of thing?
That's actually a really good question. Didn't even occur to me to share these questions ahead of time. But this is just the beginning. What we'll do is we'll collect this information and then distribute it through the department chairs to make sure that you see what the summaries were of the notes and things today, so that you have some time to think about it over the summer. Then we will be getting back together at the opening meeting and talking about this some more, so that there'll be some more opportunities, I would imagine, during professional development days as well in your college and department meetings to further have these discussions. Because the goal is to start, April is a bad month, everybody's mind's elsewhere right now, to get it started now, to continue it through the fall, so that we have something to start taking shape next January.
Cool, thanks.
So that's a good question.
Well, a couple of, this is a strange experience, but a couple of things that occur to me. I mean, I have trouble thinking about ratcheting up our admission standards. I mean, I don't like that approach. But as director of the honors program, what I can say in terms of attracting students who have those higher indexes, what I see is that they like at least, I mean, I'm more familiar with the honors students, but the honors students like the smaller classes. They like the things that you can offer them. I'm trying to offer them also some experiential things as well, like taking them on trips and various things like that. The other thing that I would want to point out, I mean, again, it's a point I've made before with you and a couple other folks, but you know, being able to offer that level of student a, you know, a smaller class, a little bit more of an individualized approach and so forth. I mean, our matriculation rate, and we just had our first cohort go through, our matriculation rate was 82% over the same period of time. Now, these are good students. They ought to finish. But if you compare that to just that profile of student, which I've asked institutional research to do, from what I can tell, it's going to be significantly higher. So I think, you know, part of that is I'm not suggesting that we ratchet up our standards, but I think if we were to make, you know, say the honors program more robust or what have you. And just to give you an idea, just because I think this is an important point to make, of that first group of 50 honors students that came in 2005, only 6 of them actually completed the program, but 82 or 83% of them graduated from the institution. So offering this sort of program greatly enhances, I think, your matriculation rate, graduation rate, completion rate for students with those higher indexes.
Okay. So what I hear then you saying is some we need to be thinking about incentives in part
sure.
to be attracting, and mm-hmm. one of those might be the honors program.
Which, yeah, you can imagine me that I, you would expect me to say that. Yeah. But yeah,
I'd be upset if you didn't.
Hey, Doug. One of the things that I think, especially in dealing with the first question, and I know that some of this work has been done, and so one of the things that I was hoping to see today was some initial thoughts related to this. But we obviously have several programs or pieces here at Northwest that are doing very well and are essentially a pair of shoulders that additional work can be built on, or that you can go far beyond rather than having such a broad base with all kinds of experiences, but to build on those experiences that have been put in place, or and maybe it's something like the academy and some of the things there, and linking to things that we have existing going on. But I think that's academically where some of our strengths may be, and it could link again to the experimental or experiential as well, where that's going to naturally attract those students. I mean, in a conference that we just spent 3 days at with students, I mean, those sessions, those areas that were thriving and doing well had that base, and they were building on that. And so from my perspective as a faculty member, I expect the administration to be able to say, well, these are the things that are strong, and let's build in those areas. Not that we can't have a breadth, but that we should build vertically as well where we can.
I think that's a good point and a good issue to bring forward. That's something that we want to, I think that we're hoping to hear come from the bottom up about where those collaborative opportunities can come in as well. I mean, certainly, I think the president has said before, he could sit down and write a strategic plan and could have had that done last October. But we want to make sure that we have general input about where everybody thinks, where the collaborations should occur and where people want them to occur. And I'm hoping that we do some more multidisciplinary studies where it makes sense. Doesn't mean it should happen everywhere, because it doesn't make sense everywhere. But where it does make sense, we need to break down the barriers that in the past have prevented us from building those relationships. And if somebody wants to team teach, we need to figure out a way to do things like that that will excite not only the faculty but the students. Is that kind of the thing that you're saying? Collaborations across departments, between departments, kind of help me and the note takers, maybe, probably just me, but
oh, sure.
Understand.
Well, And I think those are good to bubble up from the bottom, but you'll get pods of there's excitement here for a while, and then there's excitement here for a while. And not that that isn't a bad thing, but I think that there's a need of direction to say, well, maybe this is a good area, and then allow that as a possibility so that the faculty that are there, I mean, you don't want to spend too much time working up something if it's not going to come about. But if there are areas identified and then you open that up, well, you know, this seems to be a good area. Not that it's completely bubbled up from the bottom, but that that there seems to be support there.
Gotcha.
So that if you spend your time on it, it's worth it.
Yeah. Not just, you know, word support, but there's got to be other support behind that as well, infrastructure report as well.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
One of the questions has to do with experiential educational activities. A lot of us have experiential type learning that we're assessing. In the Chronicle last month, there were a couple of institutions highlighted who have developed successful ways to give credit for prior experience through describing what you've done, talking about it, writing about it. That might be another possibility to attract a particular type of student to the institution, if we could take some of the experiences that we already know how to assess and look at some of those other models and find ways to give people credit for experience they've had before they come. Could possibly work similar to a test out or something, but it might bring some additional people to campus.
Okay.
Doug, do we have the numbers of what happens to the 61% of the people that don't graduate from here? I assume we're doing exit interviews and that somebody's saying, I'm transferring to Iowa State, or I'm going home to get married, or dad died and I've got to go take care of the business. It's hard to address something if you don't know what's causing it.
Let me make sure I was clear on my statistic. 39% of those who meet our academic standard matriculate, meaning that they are accepted to come to Northwest. They don't necessarily matriculate, though, right? Or do they?
They're accepted but do not enroll and choose to attend another institution or not go to school at all.
Right. So we have, on the 61% who choose not to come here, we have looked briefly at the data, what our competition is, basically, and what other schools they're applying to. We can get the attendance data then through there's a data clearinghouse. We're trying to help support the OAIA office, the Institutional Research Office, but that's where that analysis really is going to have to take place in conjunction with enrollment management. But that's something we need to take a look at.
Well, I was just wondering, you know, how do you address something if you don't have any idea what the cause is? So if somebody can get us the cause, then we'll be in a better shape. The other thing is there any money to support anything?
Well, that's a very good question. I will answer in a couple of ways. One, I've been working with the leadership team and the Dean's Council to try to figure out how we can better support academic initiatives. One of the things that we'll be doing next year is there's been a pool of culture of quality money that the provost oversees. Some of that has gone to student affairs for distinguished lecture series, and the rest supports the improvement for teaching and learning grants and some other culture of quality grants. Now, I'm renaming that fund academic initiatives because I think what that tells people is that we're going to focus on academic initiatives. We'll still do what we call culture of quality grants and improvement of teaching and learning grants. We're not going to support the distinguished lecture series as much as we have in the past unless there's a academic link. So when I talked to Angel McAdams a couple of weeks ago about this, I said rather than getting these speakers that are high dollar, why don't we focus on the speakers that are, to use somebody else's term, medium weight, that will come here and spend 2 or 3 days with our students and in the classrooms so that there's a strong academic component to that rather than having dinner, speak, and leave. So the application process will involve them getting the academic dean and academic chair or chairs of the affected departments to sign off on this, that this is going to be a good experience, and then we'll deal with it in a grant, but at a much reduced rate, about $10,000 of support. That means, long answer here, sorry, that means that there'll be some more money available to support other academic initiatives. And I've asked the Dean's Council members to kind of go out to their groups to get some ideas on how, on what we might want to support with those funds. The second part of the answer is that, I don't know if you caught this in the President's address on Monday, I guess it was Monday, or was it yesterday? It's been a long week already. But he mentioned that we know we're going to cut at least $2.2 million. And the leadership team, in its first draft, submitted a budget for next year that had $2.2 million of cuts in it. Now, I think that's pretty astounding, that in some areas in academics there were some increases, but you all know that you gave up some money in your departments and in your operations because we know that money is from the state is going to decrease. So in order to invest in other areas, we're going to have to find money from other locations. And so collectively, we were able to increase some operations that we knew immediately needed to be increased. A perfect example is the support of student-teacher supervision. That has over 700 elementary education, curriculum instruction, supervise, and secondary ed. We supervise over 700 students now. So that means that there's more travel and there's more expense associated with that. So we increased that budget to support that. In addition, we were able to identify some, not enough, but some money for strategic initiatives and or capital improvements. And when we talk about capital, we're talking about things that we might collectively decide need to be done, whether it's a roof because a certain building continues to leak, or it's financial assistance needs new computers because the software that the government is requiring us to use now doesn't run on the old computers. So there is going to be an investment on academic initiatives. Can we spend $1 million next year or the year after that on academic initiatives? No, probably not. But some investment is going to be made. And I spoke too long because this is supposed to be a listening session.
Thank you.
Hello. I came here expecting something different, but I thought we were going to hear about what's going to happen with the university in the next 2 years in terms of the budget cuts, because it strikes me as being almost a little bit naive to I mean it's okay to have dreams. But if we really want to be the university of choice and think about increased enrollment, wouldn't we have to first at least satisfy the other part of REAP in that we actually hire the faculty needed to take care of the increased enrollment that is now being, I think, in its fourth year? Before we can even dream of to me it seems obvious that to be an attractive small university, you have to market yourself as teaching relatively small class sizes, in a way promising to teach with as many full-time faculty as possible, and I think it even was, if I remember correctly, aligned directly on our older website that, you know, at Northwest you're being taught by real faculty and not just adjuncts or TAs or something like that. But if we are now thinking about increasing the student population even more, and REAP isn't even catching up with the past increase. We have less arguments that we can use to attract students, because if we here are becoming like a big university, then of course it's more attractive to go to, I don't know, a bigger community, a bigger place, because the cultural and economic attractions are just bigger, and it's people come to Maryville because of what has made the Northwest, you know, strong, and that is small class sizes and very few TAs or adjunct teaching.
I think that's a good question. It's one that we get a lot about REAP. And you mentioned that in the fall we'll be in the fourth year of that. So we're 80% through that. And the original plan that was based on certain assumptions was that the student-faculty ratio would remain the same. Now, that was based on hiring 34 new faculty. And I think after we hire the four new REAP faculty, we'll be about... I should know this, at least a third of the way. So we're 80% of the way through the enrollment, but we're only a third of the way through the faculty. And I should mention on the staff side, we're even further behind than that. So I think that's a fair question. So let me say this, a couple of things. One, I appreciate the opportunity to clarify this because I don't think what we're saying is let's keep doing exactly the same thing that we're doing now, status quo, and build on that. We're saying we know that we're in a climate where there are limited resources and they're shrinking resources. So if we're going to have to make some tough decisions in 2 years, this is why we're here listening now. What are your priorities? Tell us what it is that you think is going to make Northwest unique. I've heard a couple of things. The class size keeps coming up, and that seems to be very important. But we can't do everything. We seem to be okay for next year's budget, but if we get cut another 10, 15, 20% in the next year, every 5%, let's see, every 1% is about $300,000 of our state appropriations. So you start multiplying that times 10, 15, 20%, we'll have to make some difficult choices. So the questions that we're here to try to get some feedback on is, where are those priorities? What should the considerations be as we're making those difficult choices? We can't continue to, and there is no plan, by the way, to continue to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. I think the president has said several times that 9,000 seems to be the point at which the university climate really changes. The research bears that out. And we're not planning on going to 9,000, so don't go outside and quote me and say, oh, we're going to 9,000. No, we've only the current plan is, the current REAP plan is to do this for two more years. But we're taking a look, Bev and I are taking a look at, we're going to take a look at the data as of this fall to see where we are. Because we understand that the faculty are under stress. We understand facilities are under stress. Anybody that's been over to the union at lunchtime understands that it takes a while to get lunch at the time. So students are experiencing some stress. And REAP was really kind of based on some assumptions at the state level that aren't there anymore. The state was at the time, you know, SB 389 was, the ink on the SB 389 was fresh. And, of course, they imposed a lot of requirements on us. You all know those, the posting of teacher evaluations, the posting of credentials, the curriculum alignment initiative, all those things are in SB 389, as was a funding, a guideline for a funding formula that was FTE-based. So at the time that REAP was planned, it made a whole heck of a lot of sense for us to increase enrollment because our state funding was going to be based on the number of students that we had enrolled. Well, then, of course, we all know what happened after that. The economy crashed, and there is no money to fund higher education. So we are aware of that, and we're taking a look at that. I lost you in the crowd. But we're taking a look at that. So the second part of this is, then, with these limited resources that we're going to have, with the shrinking resources that we're going to have, where do we want to invest our money? Where is it that we can afford to do... As our friend over in the Environmental Services, Dr. Paul McGraw, says, work smarter but not harder to make sure that we do things in the best and most efficient manner possible. And I know that efficiency word leaves a bad taste in our mouths because we've heard it in different contexts over the last years. And I'm not suggesting that we work more for less. I'm suggesting that we look at our processes to make sure that we're doing we're making the best use of our time. So that said, we have to take a look at what our priorities are, both on the academic service side, the academic program side, and on the non-academic services that we're providing. Does that clarify things a little bit?
Yes, but as a follow-up, I'm is the vocabulary that you use, is that a euphemism for potentially cutting some programs which are not feasible anymore, which are not profitable anymore?
Well, the question was, for the recording, the question was, is that a euphemism for cutting programs? And the president has said that everything's on the table. If we get cut 25%, so we get cut 5% this year and 20% next year, we're talking somewhere around $8 to $10 million of cuts. I think, you know, it would be irresponsible for me to say, we're not going to cut anything, because we would have to. We're not going to be the same institution. And that's why we have to have this discussion. We have to make sure that we all have the same shared, that we understand what our shared values are, because without reiterating what our values are and what we think is important, that's going to make it really difficult to make those budget decisions.
My turn. I guess this is a response to all three, but especially the first one. It has always been true that universities have prepared people for unpredictable worlds and unpredictable job markets. And the best things that universities do to prepare people for that is in general education, the ability to think, problem solve, communicate. So I appreciate the word differentiate as opposed to new or unique or, you know, transformative, because I think what we have been doing well for a very long time as a university is our general education program. And it's always tempting to move outside of that and look for things that are unique or different or new to try to catch additional people in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I want us to be cautious about that and not abandon what we do very well here, and that is general education. So I think the solution is simple. If our marketing people can make general education really sexy, I think we'll be in good shape. But no, seriously, I think it's something that we have to, when we're looking at the one thing that we really want to focus on that we do well, it's in general education. So if we can find ways to demonstrate that we do that better than anybody else, we'll be in good shape.
Notice that was in one of the president's comments. He specifically mentioned liberal and general education as an important component of life in education here.
Hi, Doug.
Hi.
I have a couple of comments. The first is that when I'm out in the community and I talk to people, I get referred to as a teacher, and I'm not. I am a scholar. I both instruct students and I derive new information, and we all do that. Some of us create art. Some write poetry, some discover and name new fossils. But we are scholars, we are not teachers. One of the things that we have to do if we're going to be able to recruit the best students is to let them know that they get to work with scholars, people who provide that new information. That's very, very important. And I'm not certain that that gets put across into the community, and it needs to be done. So first and foremost, that's what we have to remember. And sometimes with the demands that get placed on us and the restrictions that get placed on us, sometimes because we're not able to go and do the things we need to do, that gets lost in the shuffle, and it shouldn't. The second thing that I would state is that as a geologist, we have to go where the rocks are. You can't learn about rocks without seeing rocks. And in our department, the students pay their own way, and they should never have to pay for that experience, not on their own, not completely. We take them 1,300 feet underground into the largest lead district in the United States, which happens to be in Missouri, and it still costs them $80 a head to go, but they pay it. We take them to the Appalachians to see examples of mountain building because, let's face it, there aren't any mountains in Missouri. It costs them $300 a head to go, and they pay it. We take them to northern Michigan to see the iron mines and the Precambrian rocks, and it costs them $400 a head, and they go, and they pay it because they understand that to really learn what it is that they're trying to learn, they have to have that experience. I'm not saying that the university has to pay all of that for our requisite and representative departments. For other departments, maybe it's that trip to Cape Girardeau or St. Genevieve to see early American architecture, examples of what happened when the French moved in, to get a feel for what that was like. But there has to be a way that we help those students out, because if we combine those types of experiences with the fact that you're learning from people who really are experts when it comes to that type of experience, then that gives us a two-pronged approach. two ways that we can maybe target those students who would think Missouri or Nebraska or Kansas or Iowa State or Iowa or Kansas State, all of which are within 250 miles of us, and instead think, boy, I can go to Northwest, I can study with somebody that really knows what they're talking about, and I can do it in a group of 10 instead of a group of 50. Thank you.
I 100% agree with your first comment there, and for that, we need your help. Hopefully, you've noticed on the website that we've started featuring those sorts of stories more, but when you have something that you want us to publicize, let Mark Hornickel know. Send him an email. Make sure you CC your dean, your chair along the way, or do it through your chair and dean, however they want to do it. But make sure that we know, because there's so much stuff going on campus that we don't know about it unless somebody tells us. So, and that may, at times, that gives us an opportunity to coordinate activities as well. Earth Day is a good example of that. There were pockets of people doing things, and then we found out, oh, we could, you know, kind of collaborate and do this together. It has a greater impact. On the second one, I understand exactly what you're saying. There are some, we're hearing there are some universities around the state now that are actually considering differential tuition on the more expensive programs. We know historically it's more expensive to go to medical school than it is to go to a PhD program in psychology, for example, because those facilities and that training requires more expense. I'm not suggesting that we should do that, but that others have suggested that we can do that. So in some way, students have, you know, they're going to end up paying some way. It depends on how you want to spread it out across their career.
Well, the way it works for us, the students that can afford to get the experience in the ones that can't, and that creates a differential in learning for people in the same program.
And there may be, we do have limited number, but some programs on campus that do have program-based fees. So there may be some opportunities there for you to kind of think about that if it makes sense for your majors and your students.
Well, thanks for this opportunity. I don't want to create any enemies here, but I don't think being a scholar and being a teacher is an either-or situation. And from somebody who teaches people to be proud to be a teacher, I think it's important that we're both. I want to respond to number one up there a little bit, I think, Doug. We might want to look at this kind of the other side of the coin of what Dr. Steiner just mentioned, and coming from a department whose emphasis is not on gen eds and emphasis is more on graduate level, we might want to look at what does make us unique and what makes us interesting across the state for our purposes. And that might, we might want to begin with each department or each college examining what we do for our students and determining what sets us apart from other similar or like institutions. In education, I'll speak just briefly about that. We have a wonderful opportunity with Horace Mann that I think we could use to even greater benefit and receive even more publicity, positive publicity about what's going on there. I think we have opportunities that we have not yet explored. The connection between the academy and education is almost non-existent, and I think there's a ripe opportunity to bridge that gap. I think we have key programs that probably need to be emphasized, higher education leadership or teacher leadership. I think those programs do set us apart from like institutions. Having said that, I do think it's important that we examine our faculty workload and that we use our time wisely to the maximum benefit of our departments, our college, and to our own professional lives. I think we also might want to examine how we are promoting our programs and examine how like institutions are promoting theirs, including the AVLA advertisements that are in our own Northwest newspaper and including the inroads that William Woods has made in local schools. So that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Good comments.
I thought I saw my good friend Steve Sutton in the audience. So he knows I don't really have anything new to add. I just want to piggyback and reinforce that I wouldn't presume to know what are the programs that should be prioritized, but I would agree with all the comments that have been made today that what we already have in place and really is largely still untapped potential is the collaborative piece, experimental piece, the experiential piece, the concept of team teaching, I think I would agree with Dr. Rose that we need to make it more systematic and formalized, if you will, because it's kind of hit and miss right now. But I think that's one way that we can address both number one and number three. Thanks.
Thanks. As Alicia's coming to the microphone, I want to maybe revise question one to see if it evokes different kinds of responses. You can still answer number one if you're in line to do that. But what are those things that you think we cannot live without that we currently have? I hear general education a lot. Are there other things, whether it's academic programs, academic services, or non-academic, that you think we cannot live without that really set Northwest apart, that as we're looking toward future budgets, we need to make sure that we maintain those things?
In bridging a lot of what's already been said, Dr. Steiner said, can we make Gen Ed sexy? I think we can, and I think it's back to what Dr. Spencer said with the honors program gets them engaged in these small classes, and they've got essentially a learning community built in with the honors program. They're taking classes together. They get to integrate that information together and have a cohort. And so if we build that into thinking about where are our pockets of activity, the pockets that Dr. Wilmes mentioned, we've got opportunity to structure not just maybe the first year and the second year, but thinking about how we can create community and between our students, build on what we do have that's awesome, our faculty, and the engagement, to then look developmentally at the bigger picture of our students' education so we bring them through in a way that helps them build their capacity, engages them, and engages us, too.
Very good. I forgot to comment on the workload issue, but I agree. We've got to find ways to prioritize, and at 4 o'clock, I'm meeting with the outgoing Faculty Senate President and the incoming Faculty Senate President to kind of talk about that. We need to make sure that the faculty time is that you've got the time to be in the classroom and to do your research or creative activity. There's a danger in looking at the service side, because one of the nice things I think about Northwest is we get a lot of information and a lot of leadership from committees. So we don't want to eliminate committees for the sake of workload if that means we're not going to get needed information. Doesn't mean we can't look at the structure of those committees and the membership of those committees to make sure that faculty the faculty time is devoted, that valuable faculty time is being devoted to those areas where we need it most and where it makes sense.
This is just a real quick comment, and actually your redirection a few moments ago kind of helps out with this, and that is for question number one, what's going to differentiate us? It's not only a positive, but we also need to think about where are the things that are differentiating us in a negative way as well. Mm. The areas where we're not keeping up with the Joneses here in this region. One area where I see that being the case, and gosh, I don't know how many prospective students that come through my office, that are high school kids, and they want to know about, well, what is the likelihood of being able to do undergraduate research here on campus? And it's oftentimes a difficult question to answer for them. There are undergraduate research opportunities that are here. Faculty members are willing to make those opportunities accessible, but can we handle all of them that really need that kind of experiential type of activity? Hmm. The workload issue, as far as that concern, really isn't considered. Any of us that take on undergraduates to work in research labs, I know Renee does this, I do this, folks in chemistry, biology, physics, geology, geography, whatever the case might be, and I know all the other departments do it as well. It's not factored into our load in any way. And to really give those students a meaningful experience, we have to figure out some way to make that happen.
So. That's a really good point. Let's work next year to figure out how we can make that easier.
Thanks for doing this, Doug.
Oh,
appreciate
it. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
My question is going to be a little bit directed and in line with number one, as we see it in terms of a way where we may be falling a little bit behind some of our peers. In business, last week, Missouri Western announced that they have preliminary accreditation from AACSB. That leaves Northwest, Missouri Southern, and a couple of small schools in the state as the only schools that are not AA accredited. They are accredited by ACBSP. And I think that we really need to take a hard look at that and see if that is the way that we want to go moving forward. We may not talk about it when students come to visit campus, or it may not come up, but you know that they're talking about it at the other campuses when they go there.
Right.
So something I think we could work on.
Well, what Jason is talking about is we're currently, I affectionately call it single A accredited because I can't remember what all the letters are, but versus the double A accreditation. And there are different requirements with the double A accreditation. And in a nutshell, it requires a reduced faculty load from 12 hours to 9 hours, increased, on average, is it fair to say, increased scholarship requirements, though there you can have some professional, there's some professional component to it, but that there's also a strong research component to it, and there are some other things, i.e., it's going to be expensive to do. We have a similar situation and had in education in terms of one of the things that we get chronically downgraded on is the workload or the faculty load for the graduate faculty with regard to NCATE accreditation. So there are two areas where there are some, one where there's a potential problem and another where it's a potential problem if we want to go to AA accreditation that we have to have, I think, as a university about our whether that is a direction that we want to go. Because if you think about what the implications are, we're talking about the potential success or not success of some major areas. Business is the largest major with over 900 majors. Education is the second largest major with over 700 majors. So how do we go forward in supporting those programs? Is this type of accreditation important with the implications of what might happen in the culture? If we have some faculty doing 9-hour loads, other faculty doing 12-hour loads, are we willing to accept that? It's a conversation we need to have. Are we willing as an institution to invest that money? Now, I understand that there are going to be differing opinions, that everybody may have a different opinion about that, and this is where the leadership comes in. We have to look at all the data and the recommendations and that sort of thing and make a decision. But I think we need to talk about how that has the impact that might have on the culture also. I'm glad you brought that up. That is a good point. I think that is a unique something that we've seen differently on this side.
This relates perhaps to the theme of places where we might be falling behind, but also to question two about attracting our high quality students, the very motivated, well prepared students, and that has to do with academic scholarships. I don't have figures off the top of my head, not knowing what the questions would be, but in my work with the President's Scholars, and I understand that the President's Scholarship is the top academic scholarship, it no longer covers full tuition, where it used to not only cover full tuition, but go beyond that and go towards room and board. And I think that it is probably fairly unusual that university's top academic scholarship does not cover full tuition. I know that's also an issue, or has been in our department in the graduate program, that we have students that are very interested in coming, but they simply get better offers elsewhere. And while I would not want this to come at the expense of having a quality program for them to come to, so it's difficult to talk about in this financial climate, nevertheless, one of the things that will attract top students is those kinds of scholarship monies, and maybe that could be something that could be funded rather than through the university budget, but through alumni funds or something else.
That's a good point, and I'll look to Ori to make sure that what I'm saying is right, but the president has said several times that he wants our next campaign to be focused on academics, and a big component of that with regard to academic scholarships. And as he's been out and about talking to the alumni, getting the alumni excited about this, and has noticed a very large willingness to help out on this end. We can have a few more minutes. There's a class in here at 3:30. Yes.
I'm sorry. One of the questions that I have received in the IR office this year that has never come up before, parents and students that are calling to find out if we will guarantee that they can finish in 4 years, evidently, they perceive that there are other institutions that are making those promises. So I think that it would probably behoove us to make sure with our planning of classes that should they do everything they're supposed to do at the times they're supposed to do it, that they could finish in a reasonable amount of time and make a point of making it public.
This kind of comes back to Armin's question earlier about the lack of the REAP faculty. Well, enrollment's been growing, not having the faculty. And so we were just having this conversation this afternoon that there are some classes, the freshmen, I think, just their classes just opened up, and there are many classes that are already closed and probably have waiting lists. And I'm sure that applies in many departments across campus. That's going to be one of our challenges. It's a very good point. We need to see if there's some creative ways that we can try to remedy to this. I don't know to what degree software can help us with this, but our new degree work software that allows students to develop four-year plans online and allows department chairs and advisors to view those plans online so we can get some indication of when students may be taking certain classes and try to arrange schedules that way. Perhaps there's some opportunities there. I don't know. It may just be that in some areas there's such demand that that may be something difficult, but certainly it's something we need to attend to. That's a really good point.
Can I talk loud? Do I need to try my mic? Can I talk loud?
You want to come down here?
Can I just talk really loud?
I'll repeat your question. Okay. It's a good comment. Lori mentioned that lots of students will go home this summer because they need to work and aren't able to find online courses, so they might from Northwest, and so they might go to a community college or something like that. Really good point. I don't know if Roger's here, but I think last summer 40% of our enrollment was online based, and he thinks that this year it'll probably go over 50, maybe a little bit over 50% of our enrollment in the summer is going to be online based. So what that's telling us, it's a validation of what you just said, that if the courses are offered, likely there will be enrollment in those courses. Mark, did you have another question?
Well, kind of addresses point three, experiential. I think one of the problems I see with us being stuck in after cows and chickens is that our students can't get internships very well. I don't know if it's good marketing management or not, but because we're not in a big city, we're not close to major employers. At the same time, we've got the Kansas City Center, which we've been focusing upon graduate education, but it seems like that could be a springboard for us to get maybe more undergraduates involved in internships in Kansas City, maybe offering, say, not just so those students that are down there not just take internships, say the academic year, but also take maybe certain undergraduate courses at that center, so they wouldn't they wouldn't be losing out in terms of, say, falling behind in terms of getting the rework done. Another issue we found out...
Let me summarize this for the recording here, that one of the issues is the challenge that we have amongst the cows and chickens. I'm sorry to ag folks if we're going to think you have something against cows and chickens, but there are limited internship opportunities here in this immediate region. And the other is an opportunity for us perhaps to look for undergraduate education opportunities at the Kansas City Center.
Yeah, particularly if we have students doing internships at the school year in Kansas City.
Linking those to the people who might be doing internships in Kansas City. That's a good idea.
The other issue is that we found out talking to our MBA students in Kansas City is that part of the reason why our enrollments are kind of sudden is that they don't know us. They don't know about our presence, and I don't know whether that's also a problem at the graduate level in the extent that we're being drowned out by Central, or drowned out by K-State or KU, or other schools we're competing with in the Kansas City market. And maybe if we use that graduate center there as kind of a beacon, saying, well, we're also not a graduate institution, that might draw some more kids in from Kansas City.
Okay. Increased awareness of our graduate programs in the metropolitan areas.
I'd like to follow up on Mark's comment about internships. And in our department, it's about 20% of the kids take an internship, which to me is a little bit, I mean, it's low for the campus, I know for the university, but it's remarkably high because, as a general rule, faculty don't get paid for overseeing internships. It's something you do out of the kindness of your heart for students during the regular academic year. So even if we're down at Liberty, it's still, the system does not reward me taking on 5 or 6 students. It's all personal rewards, I got that. There's no systematic, there's no organization rewards. It's, yeah, you can do that if you find a professor to oversee it. Now, in the summer, we do get paid, but it's different during the year. And I know that frustrations from the Department of Higher Education, don't blame us. How can we increase internships in this department? The answer is, well, we've got plenty of work to do already, you know.
Well, to kind of put together a couple of things, what I hear then is the experiential learning, if we're going to make this a priority, and by the way, the state and its Imperatives for Change, the coordinated plan for higher education in Missouri, has said this is one of the goals, that we should be increasing experiential learning for our students. And in fact, now we are actually reporting, based on course numbers that you gave us, courses that have some sort of experiential learning component to them, we report those now to the state. State's not going to come in and say you must do this, but it's going to appear on their dashboard. So what we're saying is, if we're committed to this and we're committed to advancing it and we agree that experiential learning is important, that we ought to make sure, just like we would with undergraduate research, that there is a that we consider as part of the workload, that that faculty are recognized for the amount of time that it requires to supervise these sorts of activities. So hopefully the note takers will get that down to make sure that we take a look at those things collectively. Now, we promised you it was going to be an hour, and if it ran a little bit longer, that's fine. Understanding, if you need to leave, please do. I don't want to prevent anybody from sharing, though, and maybe you have a question. This is the first opportunity, actually, you probably had to ask me questions. I'm happy to answer some questions if you have any for me, but I want to make sure that we have an opportunity to listen to you before we take off today.
What hasn't been discussed up until now is the idea of, it could be part of one or it could be part of three, but the idea of the value of internationalization on campus. In other words, in the last 2 years, I think we've added institutional requirements that address the international education of sorts. I think that's how it goes. But the point is that our recruitment efforts, as well as programs that focus a little bit on international education, up until this point in this discussion here, have not been brought up. And I happen to think that in the international definition of critical thinking skills, I think that that international education, I mean, the ability to think critically is tied in with the idea of intercultural competence. And intercultural competence is, for the most part, brought about by being able to effectively communicate with people who are, you know, of different cultures or different races and so forth. I just wonder whether we do value that enough that it would be part of our psychic, part of our thinking, and part of our strategic planning.
I think that's a good comment. Well, what I will leave you with is that I thank you for coming today and sharing this. And again, this is the beginning, not the end. So as you think about these questions, feel free to send me an email with additional thoughts. Some of you may have been hesitant to talk on the microphones and speak, and you may have specific ideas that you thought weren't appropriate for a general crowd. That's fine. Send them my way. We'll take them, and I'll forward them to the note takers, and I'll take your name off if you want me to, just as long as we get the ideas, as long as we get the input. Since we're getting close to the end of the trimester, what I want to tell you is that I'm, as the president mentioned, I'm kind of rethinking about the associate provost position, and I think you may remember way back in January he mentioned about a vice provost of graduate studies and academic program growth. And that's likely what I'm going to do with that position, is basically combine the graduate dean, which is a half-time position, with the associate provost position, which is a full-time position, into one position. So you'll be getting an email sometime. I hope to do it before the end of the school year, but things are coming to a close pretty quickly, and the timing of my appointment and all this kind of stuff just makes it, the timing is not great. I'm very sensitive because I've been on the faculty fairly recently, that people are very sensitive that things happen, seem to happen when we're in summer break. And I don't want you to think that this is coming out, and especially since Dean Rule has announced his retirement, we're going to have to start work on that. And I'll be talking to the chairs and various groups about the search committees there. But we're still here in the summertime, so we still have to do some work. I'll do as much communication via email as possible so that you know what's going on. But please don't think that I'm waiting until April 28th, until everybody is gone, or May 2nd, to do some of this stuff. It's just a matter of getting it timed, approved to the Board of Regents and that sort of thing for their consent. So I'll keep you apprised via email as much as I can this summer. Thank you very much for coming today. Like I said, any more information, send it our way.